turn to me and say, "This is the turning point of the war. We've finally stopped them. We're finally safe." But instead his little penis popped out and he peed in my face.
Part 5. Homefront, USA. Taos, New Mexico. Arthur Sinclair Jr. is the picture of an old-world patrician. Tall, lean, with close-cropped white hair and an affected Harvard accent. He speaks into the ether, rarely making eye contact or pausing for questions. During the war, Mr. Sinclair was director of the U.S. government's newly formed DESTRESS, or Department of Strategic Resources.
I don't know who first thought of the acronym DESTRESS, or if they consciously knew how much it sounded like distress, but it certainly could not have been more appropriate. Establishing a defensive line at the Rocky Mountains might have created a theoretical safe zone, but in reality that zone consisted mainly of rubble and refugees. There was starvation, disease, homelessness in the millions. Industry was in shambles, transportation and trade had evaporated. And all of this was compounded by the living dead, both assaulting the Rocky line and festering within our safe zone. We had to get our people on their feet again, clothed, fed, housed, back to work. Otherwise, this supposed safe zone was only forestalling the inevitable. That was why distress was created. And as you can imagine, I had a lot of on-the-job training. Those first months, I can't tell you how much information I had to cram into this withered old cortex. The briefings, the inspection tours. When I did sleep, it was with a book under my pillow. Each night a new one, from Henry J. Kaiser to Vo Nguyen Giap. I needed every lesson, every word, every ounce of knowledge and wisdom to help me fuse a fractured landscape into the modern American war machine. If my father had been alive, he probably would have laughed at my frustration. He'd been a staunch New Dealer, working closely with FDR as controller of New York State. He used methods that were almost Marxist in nature, the kind of collectivization that would make Ayn Rand leap from her grave and join the ranks of the living dead. I'd always rejected the wisdom he tried to impart, running as far away as Wall Street to shut it out. Now I was racking my brains to remember it. One thing those New Dealers did better than any generation in American history was find and harvest the right tools and talent.
Tools and talent?
A term my son heard once in a movie. I found it described our reconstruction efforts rather well. Talent describes the potential workforce, its level of skilled labor, and how that labor can be utilized effectively. To be perfectly candid, our supply of talent was at a critical low. Ours was a post-industrial or service-based economy, so complex and highly specialized that each individual could only function within the confines of its narrow compartmentalized structure. You should have seen some of the careers listed on our first employment census. Everyone was some version of an executive or a representative, an analyst or a consultant, all perfectly suited to the pre-war world, but all totally inadequate for the present crisis. We needed carpenters, masons, machinists, gunsmiths. We had those people, to be sure, but not nearly as many as were necessary. The first labor survey stated clearly that over 65% of the present civilian workforce were classified F6, possessing no valued vocation. We required a massive job retraining program. In short, we needed to get a lot of white collars dirty. It was slow going. Air traffic was non-existent. Roads and rail lines were a shambles. And fuel. Good Lord, you couldn't find a tank of gas between Blaine, Washington and Imperial Beach, California. Add to this the fact that pre-war America not only had a commuter-based infrastructure, but that such a method also allowed for severe levels of economic segregation. You would have entire suburban neighborhoods of upper-middle-class professionals, none of whom had possessed even the basic know-how to replace a cracked window. Those with that knowledge lived in their own blue-collar ghettos, an hour away in pre-war auto traffic, which translated to at least a full day on foot. Make no mistake, bipedal locomotion was how most people traveled in the beginning. Solving this problem, no, challenge, there were no problems, was the refugee camps. There were hundreds of them. Some parking lots small, some spreading for miles, scattered across the mountains and coast, all requiring government assistance. all acute drains on rapidly diminishing resources. At the top of my list, before I tackled any other challenge, these camps had to be emptied. Anyone F6 but physically able became unskilled labor, clearing rubble, harvesting crops, digging graves. A lot of graves had to be dug. Anyone A1, those with war-appropriate skills, became part of our CSSP, or Community Self-Sufficiency Program. A mixed group of instructors would be tasked with infusing these sedentary, overeducated, desk-bound cubicle mice with the knowledge necessary to make it on their own. It was an instant success. Within 3 months, you saw a marked drop in requests for government aid. I can't stress how vital this was to victory. It allowed us to transition from a zero-sum survival-based economy into full-blown war production. This was the National Re-Education Act, the organic outgrowth of the CSSP. I'd say it was the largest jobs training program since the Second World War, and easily the most radical in our history.
You've mentioned on occasion the problems faced by the NRA.
I was getting to that. The president gave me the kind of power I needed to meet any physical or logistical challenge. Unfortunately, what neither he nor anyone on Earth could give me was the power to change the way people thought. As I explained, America was a segregated workforce, and in many cases that segregation contained a cultural element. A great many of our instructors were first-generation immigrants. These were the people who knew how to take care of themselves, how to survive on very little and work with what they had. These were the people who tended small gardens in their backyards, who repaired their own homes, who kept their appliances running for as long as mechanically possible. It was crucial that these people teach the rest of us to break from our comfortable, disposable consumer lifestyle, even though their labor had allowed us to maintain that lifestyle in the first place. Yes, there was racism, but there was also classism. You're a high-powered corporate attorney. You've spent most of your life reviewing contracts, brokering deals, talking on the phone. That's what you're good at. That's what's made you rich and what's allowed you to hire a plumber to fix your toilet, which allowed you to keep talking on the phone. The more work you do, the more money you make, the more peons you hire to free you up to make more money. That's the way the world works. But one day it doesn't. No one needs a contract reviewed or a deal brokered. What they do need is toilets fixed. And suddenly that peon is your teacher, maybe even your boss. For some, this was scarier than the living dead. Once on a fact-finding tour through L.A., I sat on the back of a re-education lecture. The trainees had all held lofty positions in the entertainment industry, a mélange of agents, managers, creative executives, whatever the hell that means. I could understand their resistance, their arrogance. Before the war, entertainment had been the most valued export of the United States. Now they were being trained as custodians for a munitions plant in Bakersfield, California. One woman, a casting director, exploded. How dare they degrade her like this? She had an MFA in conceptual theater. She had cast the top 3 grossing sitcoms in the last 5 seasons, and she had made more in a week than her instructor could dream of in several lifetimes. She kept addressing that instructor by her first name. Magda, she kept saying. Magda, enough already. Magda, please. At first, I thought this woman was just being rude, degrading the instructor by refusing to use her title. I found out later that Mrs. Magda Antonova used to be this woman's cleaning lady. Yes, it was very hard for some, but a lot of them later admitted that they got more emotional satisfaction from their new jobs than anything closely resembling their old ones. I met one gentleman on a coastal ferry from Portland to Seattle. He had worked in the licensing department for an advertising agency, specifically in charge of procuring the rights to classic rock songs for television commercials. Now he was a chimney sweep, given that most homes in Seattle had lost their central heat, and the winters were now longer and colder. He was seldom idle. "I help keep my neighbors warm," he said proudly. I know it sounds a little too Norman Rockwell, but I hear stories like that all the time. You see those shoes? I made them. That sweater, that's my sheep's wool. Like the corn, my garden. That was the upshot of a more localized system. It gave people the opportunity to see the fruits of their labor. It gave them a sense of individual pride to know that they were making a clear, concrete contribution to victory. It gave me a wonderful feeling that I was part of that. I needed that feeling. It kept me sane for the other part of my job. So much for talent. Tools are the weapons of war, and the industrial and logistical means by which those weapons are constructed.
He swivels in his chair, motioning to a picture above his desk. I lean closer and see that it's not a picture, but a framed label.
Ingredients. Molasses from the United States, anise from Spain, licorice from France, vanilla, bourbon from Madagascar, cinnamon from Sri Lanka, cloves from Indonesia, wintergreen from China, pimento berry oil from Jamaica, balsam oil from Peru. And that's just for a bottle of peacetime root beer. We're not even talking about something like a desktop PC or a nuclear-powered aircraft carrier. Ask anyone how the Allies won the Second World War. Those with very little knowledge might answer it was our numbers or generalship. Those without any knowledge might point to techno-marvels like radar or the atom bomb.
Sinclair scowls.
Anyone with the most rudimentary understanding of that conflict will give you three real reasons. First, the ability to manufacture more materiel, more bullets, beans, and bandages than the enemy. Second, the natural resources available to manufacture that materiel. And third, the logistical means not only to transport those resources to the factories, but also to transport them out to the front lines. The Allies had the resources, industry, and logistics of an entire planet. The Axis, on the other hand, had to depend on what scant assets they could scrape up within their borders. This time, we were the Axis. The Living Dead controlled most of the world's landmass, while American war production depended on what could be harvested within the limits of the Western states specifically. Forget raw materials from safe zones overseas. Our merchant fleet was crammed to the decks with refugees, while fuel shortages had dry-docked most of our navy. We had some advantages. California's agricultural base could at least erase the problem of starvation if it could be restructured. The citrus growers didn't go quietly. Neither did the ranchers. The beef barons who controlled so much prime potential farmland were the worst. You ever hear of Don Hill? Ever see the movie Roy Elliott did on him? It was when the infestation hit the San Joaquin Valley. The dead swarming over his fences, attacking his cattle, tearing them apart like African driver ants. And there he was in the middle of it all, shooting and hollering like Gregory Peck in Duel in the Sun. I dealt with him openly and honestly. As with everyone else, I gave him the choice. I reminded him that winter was coming and there were still a lot of very hungry people out there. I warned him that when the hordes of starving refugees showed up to finish what the Living Dead started, he'd have no government protection whatsoever. Hill was a brave, stubborn bastard, but he wasn't an idiot. He agreed to surrender his land and herd only on the condition that his and everyone else's breeding stock remained untouched. We shook on that. Tender, juicy steaks. Can you think of a better icon of our pre-war artificial standard of living? And yet it was that standard that ended up being our second great advantage. The only way to supplement our resource base was recycling. This was nothing new. The Israelis had started when they sealed their borders, and since then each nation had adopted it to one degree or another. None of their stockpiles, however, could even compare to what we had at our disposal. Think about what life was like in the pre-war America. Even those considered middle class enjoyed or took for granted a level of material comfort unheard of by any other nation at any other time in human history. The clothing, the kitchenware, the electronics, the automobiles, just in the Los Angeles basin alone, outnumbered the pre-war population by 3 to 1. The cars poured in by the millions, every house, every neighborhood. We had an entire industry of over 100,000 employees working 3 shifts, 7 days a week. Collecting, cataloging, disassembling, storing and shipping parts and pieces to factories all over the coast. It was a little trouble, like with the cattle ranchers, people not wanting to turn over their Hummers or vintage Italian midlife crisis mobiles. It's funny, no gas to run them, but they still hung on anyway. Didn't bother me too much. They were a pleasure to deal with compared to the military establishment. Of all my adversaries, easily the most tenacious were the ones in uniform. I never had any direct control over any of their R&D. They were free to greenlight whatever they wanted. But given that almost all their programs were farmed out to civilian contractors and that those contractors depended on resources controlled by distress, I had de facto control. "You cannot mothball our stealth bombers," they would yell. "Who the blank do you think you are to cancel our production of tanks?" At first I tried to reason with them. "The M1 Abrams has a jet engine. Where are you going to find that kind of fuel? Why do you need stealth aircraft against an enemy that doesn't have radar?" I tried to make them see that given what we had to work with, as opposed to what we were facing, we simply had to get the largest return on our investment, or in their language, the most bang for our buck. They were insufferable. with their all-hours phone calls or just showing up in my office unannounced. I guess I can't really blame them, not after how we all treated them after the last brushfire war. And certainly not after almost having their asses handed to them at Yonkers. They were teetering on the edge of total collapse. And a lot of them just needed somewhere to vent.
He grins confidently.
I started my career trading on the floor of the New York Stock Exchange, so I can yell as hard and long as any professional drill sergeant. After each meeting, I'd expect the call, the one I'd been dreading and hoping for. Mr. Sinclair, this is the president. I just want to thank you for the job you've done for us, and we'll no longer be requiring you. It never came. My guess is no one else wanted the job.
His smile fades.
I could have gone head-to-head against the military for the duration of the war, but I'm grateful in the end that I didn't have to. When Travis D'Ambrosio became chairman of the Joint Chiefs, he not only invented the resource-to-kill ratio, but developed a comprehensive strategy to employ it. I always listened to him when he told me a certain weapon system was vital. I trusted his opinion in matters like the new infantry BDU or the standard infantry rifle. What was so amazing was to see how the culture of RKR began to take hold among the rank and file. You'd hear soldiers talking on the street, in bars, or on the train. Why have X when for the same price you could have 10 Ys, which could kill 100 times as many Zs? Soldiers even began coming up with ideas on their own, inventing more cost-effective tools than we could have envisioned. I think they enjoyed it, improvising, adapting, outthinking the bureaucrats. The Marines surprised me the most. I'd always bought into the myth of the stupid jarhead, the knuckle-dragging, lock-jawed, testosterone-driven Neanderthal. I never knew that because the Corps always has to procure its assets through the Navy, and because admirals are never going to get too fired up about land warfare, that improvisation has had to be one of their most treasured virtues.
Sinclair points above my head to the opposite wall. On it hangs a heavy steel rod ending in what looks like a fusion of shovel and double-bladed battle axe. Its official designation is the Standard Infantry Entrenchment Tool, although, to most, it is known as either the lobotomizer or simply the Lobo.
The Leathernecks came up with that one, using nothing but the steel of recycled cars. We made 23 million during the war.
He smiles with pride.
And they're still making them today.
Burlington, Vermont. Winter has come later this season, as it has every year since the end of the war. Snow blankets the house and surrounding farmland, and frosts the trees that shade the dirt track by the river. Everything about this scene is peaceful, except for the man with me. He insists on calling himself the Wacko, because everyone else calls me that, why shouldn't you? His stride is fast and purposeful. The cane given to him by his doctor and wife serves only to stab at the air.
To be honest, I wasn't surprised to be nominated for vice president. Everyone knew a coalition party was inevitable. I'd been a rising star, at least until I self-destructed. That's what they said about me, right? All the cowards and hypocrites who'd rather die than see a real man express his passion. So what if I wasn't the world's best politician? I said what I felt, I wasn't afraid to say it loud and clear, and that's one of the main reasons I was the logical choice for co-pilot. We made a great team. He was the light, I was the heat. Different parties, different personalities, and let's not kid ourselves, different skin colors as well. I knew I wasn't the first choice. I know who my party secretly wanted, but America wasn't ready to go that far. Stupid, ignorant, and generally infuriatingly Neolithic as it sounds. They'd rather have a screaming radical for a VP than another one of those people. So I wasn't surprised at my nomination. I was surprised at everything else.
You mean the elections?
Elections? Honolulu was still a madhouse. Soldiers, congressmen, refugees, all bumping into one another trying to find something to eat or a place to sleep or just to find out what the hell was going on. And that was paradise next to the mainland. The Rocky Line was just being established. Everything west of it was a war zone. Why go through all the trouble of elections when you could have Congress simply vote for extended emergency powers? The Attorney General had tried it when he was mayor of New York and almost got away with it, too. I explained to the president that we didn't have the energy or resources to do anything but fight for our very existence.
What did he say?
Well, let's just say he convinced me otherwise.
Can you elaborate?
I could, but I don't want to mangle his words. The old neurons aren't firing like they used to.
Please try.
You'll fact-check with his library?
I promise.
Well, we were in his temporary office, the presidential suite of a hotel. He'd just been sworn in on Air Force Two. His old boss was sedated in the suite next to us. From the window, you could see the chaos on the streets. The ships at sea lining up to dock, the planes coming in every 30 seconds, and ground crew pushing them off the runway once they landed to make room for new ones. I was pointing to them, shouting and gesturing with the passion I'm most famous for. We need a stable government, and fast. I kept saying, elections are great in principle, but this is no time for high ideals. The president was cool, a lot cooler than me. Maybe it was all that military training. He said to me, this is the only time for high ideals, because those ideals are all that we have. We aren't just fighting for our physical survival, but for the survival of our civilization. We don't have the luxury of old world pillars. We don't have a common heritage. We don't have millennia of history. All we have are the dreams and promises that bind us together. All we have is what we want to be. You see what he was saying? Our country only exists because people believed in it. And if it wasn't strong enough to protect us from this crisis, then what future could it ever hope to have? He knew that America wanted a Caesar, but to be one would mean the end of America. They say great times make great men. I don't buy it. I saw a lot of weakness, a lot of filth. People who should have risen to the challenge and either couldn't or wouldn't. Greed, fear, stupidity, and hate. I saw it before the war. I see it today. My boss was a great man. We were damn lucky to have him. The business of elections really set the tone for this entire administration. So many of his proposals look crazy at first glance, but once you peeled back the first layer, you realize that underneath there existed a center of irrefutable logic. Take the new punishment laws. Those really set me off. Putting people in stocks, whipping them in town squares? What was this, Old Salem? The Taliban's Afghanistan? It sounded barbaric, un-American, until you really thought about the options. What were you going to do with the thieves and looters? Put them in prison? Who would that help? Who could afford to divert active, able-bodied citizens to feed, clothe, and guard other able-bodied citizens? More importantly, why remove the punished from society when they could serve as such a valuable deterrent? Yes, there was the fear of pain, the lash, the cane, but all of that paled when compared to public humiliation. People were terrified of having their crimes exposed. At a time when everybody was pulling together, helping each other out, working to protect and take care of one another, the worst thing you could do to someone was to march them up into the public square with a giant poster reading, "I stole my neighbor's firewood." Shame's a powerful weapon, but it depended on everyone else doing the right thing. No one is above the law, and seeing a senator given 15 lashes for his involvement in war profiteering did more to curb crime than a cop on every street corner. Yes, there were the work gangs, but those were the recidivists, those who had been given chances time and time again. I remember the Attorney General suggesting that we dump as many of them into the infested zones as possible, rid ourselves of the drain and potential hazard of their continued presence. Both the President and I opposed this proposition. My objections were ethical. His were practical. We were still talking about American soil, infested, yes, but hopefully one day to be liberated. The last thing we needed, he said, was to come up against one of these ex-cons as the new Grand High Emperor of Duluth. I thought he was joking, but later, as I saw the exact thing happen in other countries, as some exiled criminals rose to command their own isolated and in some cases powerful fiefdoms, I realized we'd dodged one hell of a speeding bullet. The work gangs were always an issue for us, politically, socially, even economically. But what other choice did we have for those who refused to play nice with others?
You did use the death penalty.
Only in extreme cases. Sedition, sabotage, attempted political secession. Zombies weren't the only enemies, at least not in the beginning.
The fundies?
Well, we had our share of religious fundamentalists. What country didn't? Many of them believed that we were in some way interfering with God's will. I'm sorry, I've got to learn to be more sensitive, but for crying out loud, you really think the supreme creator of the infinite multiverse is going to have his plans unraveled by a few Arizona National Guardsmen?
He waves the thought away.
They got a lot more press than they should have, all because that nutbird tried to kill the president. In reality, they were much more a danger to themselves. All those mass suicides, the Mercy child killings in Medford. Terrible business. Same with the greenies, the lefty version of the fundies. They believed that since the living dead only consumed animals but not plants, it was the will of the divine goddess to favor flora over fauna. They made a little trouble dumping herbicide in the town's water supply, booby-trapping trees so loggers couldn't use them for war production. That kind of eco-terrorism eats up headlines, but it didn't really threaten our national security. The Rebs, on the other hand, armed organized political secessionists. That was easily our most tangible danger. It was also the only time I ever saw the president worried. He wouldn't let on, not with that dignified diplomatic veneer. In public, he treated it as just another issue, like food rationing or road repair. He'd say in private, "They must be eliminated swiftly, decisively, and by any means necessary." Of course, he was only talking about those within the Western safe zone. These diehard renegades either had some beef with the government's wartime policy or had already planned to secede years before and were just using the crisis as their excuse. These were the enemies of our country, the domestic ones. Anyone swearing to defend our country mentions in his or her oath. We didn't have to think twice about an appropriate response to them. But the secessionists east of the Rockies and some of the besieged isolated zones, that's when it got complicated.
Why is that?
Because, as the saying went, we didn't leave America. America left us. There's a lot of truth to that. We deserted those people. Yes, we left some special forces volunteers, tried to supply them by sea and air, but from a purely moral standing, these people were truly abandoned. I couldn't blame them for wanting to go their own way. Nobody could. That's why when we began to reclaim lost territory, we allowed every secessionist enclave a chance for peaceful reintegration.
But there was violence.
I still have nightmares. Places like Bolivar and the Black Hills. I never see the actual images, not the violence or the aftermath. I always see my boss, this towering, powerful, vital man, getting sicker and weaker each time. He survived so much, shouldered such a crushing burden. You know, he never tried to find out what happened to his relatives in Jamaica. Never even asked. He was so fiercely focused on the fate of our nation, so determined to preserve the dream that created it. I don't know if great times make great men, but I know they can kill them.
Wenatchee, Washington. Joe Muhammad's smile is as broad as his shoulders. While his day job is as the owner of the town's bicycle repair shop, his spare time is spent sculpting molten metal into exquisite works of art. He is, no doubt, most famous for the bronze statue on the Mall in Washington, D.C., the neighborhood security memorial of two standing citizens and one seated in a wheelchair.
The recruiter was clearly nervous. She tried to talk me out of it. Had I spoken to the NRA representative first? Did I know about all the other essential war work? I didn't understand at first. I already had a job at the recycling plant. That was the point of neighborhood security teams, right? It was a part-time volunteer service for when you were home from work. I tried explaining this to her. Maybe there was something I wasn't getting. As she tried some other half-hearted, half-assed excuses, I saw her eyes flick to my chair.
Joe is disabled.
Can you believe that? Here we were with mass extinction knocking on the door, and she's trying to be politically correct? I laughed. I laughed right in her face. What? Did she think I just showed up without knowing what was expected of me? Didn't this dumb bitch read her own security manual? Well, I'd read it. The whole point of the NST program was to patrol your own neighborhood, walking, or in my case, rolling down the sidewalk, stopping to check each house. If, for some reason, you had to go inside, at least two members were always supposed to wait out in the street.
Motions to himself.
Hello? And what did she think we were facing anyway? It's not like we had to chase them over fences and across backyards. They came to us. And if and when they did so, let's just say, for the sake of argument, there was more than we can handle. Shit. If I couldn't roll myself faster than a walking zombie, how could I have lasted this long? I stated my case very clearly and calmly, and I even challenged her to present a scenario in which my physical state could be an impediment. She couldn't. There was some mumbling about having to check with her CO. Maybe I could come back tomorrow. I refused. Told her she could call her CO and his CO and everyone right up to the bear himself, but I wasn't moving until I got my orange vest. I yelled so loud everyone in the room could hear. All eyes turned to me, then to her. That did it. I got my orange vest and was out of there faster than anyone else that day. Like I said, neighborhood security literally means patrolling the neighborhood. It's a quasi-military outfit. We attended lectures and training courses. There were designated leaders and fixed regulations, but you never had to salute or call people sir or shit like that. Armament was pretty non-regulation as well. Mostly hand-to-hand jobs, hatchets, bats, a few crowbars and machetes. We didn't have Lobos yet. At least three people in your team had to have guns. I carried an AMT Lightning, this little semi-auto 22 caliber carbine. It had no kicks, so I could shoot without having to lock down my wheels. Good gun, especially when ammo became standardized and reloads were still available. Teams changed depending on your schedule. It was pretty chaotic back then, de-stress reorganizing everything. Night shift was always tough. You forget how dark the night really is without streetlights. There were barely any house lights, too. People went to bed pretty early back then, usually when it got dark, so except for a few candles or if someone had a license for a generator, like if they were doing essential war work from home, the houses were pitch black. You didn't even have the moon or the stars anymore. Too much crap in the atmosphere. We patrolled with flashlights, basic civilian store-bought models. We still had batteries then, with red cellophane on the end to protect our night vision. We'd stop at each house, knock, ask whoever was on watch if everything was okay. The early months were a little unnerving because of the resettlement program. So many people were coming out of the camps that each day you might get at least a dozen new neighbors or even housemates. I never realized how good we had it before the war, tucked away in my little Stepford Suburbistan. Did I really need a 3,000-square-foot house, 3 bedrooms, 2 baths, a kitchen, living room, den, and home office? I'd lived alone for years, and suddenly I had a family from Alabama, 6 of them, just showing up at my door one day with a letter from the Department of Housing. It's unnerving at first, but you get used to it quickly. I didn't mind the Shannons. That was the family's name. We got along pretty well, and I always slept better with someone standing watch. That was one of the new rules for people at home. Someone had to be the designated night watchman. We had all their names on a list to make sure they weren't squatters and looters. We'd check their ID, their face, ask them if everything was all quiet. They usually said yes, or maybe reported some noise we'd have to check out. By the second year, when the refugees stopped coming and everyone got to know each other, we didn't bother with lists and IDs anymore. Everything was calmer then. That first year, when the cops were still reforming and the safe zones weren't completely pacified.
Shivers for dramatic effect.
There were still a lot of deserted houses, shot up or broken into or just abandoned with the doors left wide open. We'd put police tape across all doorways and windows. If any of them were found snapped, that could mean a zombie was in the house. That happened a couple of times. I'd wait outside, rifle ready. Sometimes you'd hear shouts, sometimes shots. Sometimes you'd just hear a moan, scuffling. Then one of your teammates would come out with a bloody hand weapon and a severed head. I had to put a few down myself. Sometimes, when the team was inside, and I was watching the street, I'd hear a noise, a shuffling, a rasping, something dragging itself through the bushes. I'd hit it with the light, call for backup, then take it down. One time, I almost got tagged. We were clearing a two-story job. Four bed, four bath, partially collapsed from where someone had driven a Jeep Liberty through the living room window. My partner asked if it was cool to take a powder break. I let her go behind the bushes. My bad. I was too distracted, too concerned with what was going on inside the house. I didn't notice what was behind me. Suddenly, there was this tug on my chair. I tried to turn, but something had the right wheel. I twisted, brought my light around. It was a dragger, the kind that's lost its legs. It snarled up at me from the asphalt, trying to climb over the wheel. The chair saved my life. It gave me the second and a half I needed to bring my carbine around. If I'd been standing, it might have grabbed my ankle, maybe even taken a chunk. That was the last time I slacked off at my job. Zombies weren't the only problem we had to deal with back then. There were looters, not so much hardened criminals as just people who needed stuff to survive. Same with squatters. Both cases usually ended well. We'd just invite them home, give them what they needed, take care of them until the housing folks could step in. There were some real looters, though. Real bad guys. That was the only time I got hurt.
He pulls down his shirt, exposing a circular scar the size of a pre-war dime.
9 millimeter, right through the shoulder. My team chased him out of the house. I ordered him to halt. That was the only time I ever killed someone, thank God. When the new laws came in, conventional crime pretty much dried up altogether. Then there were the ferals, you know, the homeless kids who'd lost their parents. We'd find them curled up in basements, in closets, under beds. A lot of them had walked from as far away as back east. They were in bad shape, all malnourished and sickly. A lot of times they'd run. Those were the only times I felt bad, you know, that I couldn't chase them. Someone else would go. A lot of times they'd catch up, but not always. The biggest problem were Quislings.
Quislings?
Yeah, you know, the people that went nutballs and started acting like zombies.
Could you elaborate?
Well, I'm not a shrink, so I don't know all the tech terms.
It's all right.
Well, as I understand it, there's a type of person who just can't deal with a fight-or-die situation. They're always drawn to what they're afraid of. Instead of resisting it, they want to please it, join it, try to be like it. I guess that happens in kidnap situations, you know, like a Patty Hearst, Stockholm Syndrome type, or like in regular war, when people who are invaded sign up for the enemy's army. Collaborators, sometimes even more die-hard than the people they're trying to mimic, like those French fascists who were some of Hitler's last troops. Maybe that's why we call them Quislings, like it's a French word or something. But you couldn't do it in this war. You couldn't just throw up your hands and say, "Hey, don't kill me, I'm on your side." There was no gray area in this fight, no in between. I guess some people just couldn't accept that. It put them right over the edge. They started moving like zombies, sounding like them, even attacking and trying to eat other people. That's how we found our first one. He was a male adult, mid-30s, dirty, dazed, shuffling down the sidewalk. We thought he was just in Z-shock until he bit one of our guys, Perez, in the arm. That was a horrible few seconds. I dropped the cue with a headshot, then turned to check on my buddy. He was crumpled on the curb, swearing, crying, staring at the gash in his forearm. This was a death sentence, and he knew it. He was ready to do himself until we discovered that the guy I shot had bright red blood pouring from his head. When we checked his flesh, we found he was still warm. You should have seen Perez lose it. It's not every day you get a reprieve from the big governor in the sky. Ironically, Perez almost died anyway. The bastard had so much bacteria in his mouth that it caused a near-fatal staph infection. We thought maybe we stumbled onto some new discovery, but it turned out it'd been happening for a while. The CDC was just about to go public. They even sent an expert up from Oakland to brief us on what to do if we encountered more of them. It blew our minds. Did you know that Quislings were the reason some people used to think they were immune? They were also the reason all those bullshit wonder drugs got so much hype. Think about it. Someone's on Phalanx, that fake antiviral that was so popular before the plague really hit the U.S., and gets bit but survives. What else is he going to think? He probably wouldn't know there was even such a thing as Quislings. They're just as hostile as regular zombies and in some cases even more dangerous. I think the saddest thing about them is they gave up so much and in the end lost anyway.
Why is that?
Because even though we can't tell the difference between them, the real zombies can. Remember early in the war, when everybody was trying to work on a way to turn the living dead against one another? There was all this documented proof about infighting, eyewitness accounts, and even footage of one zombie attacking another. Stupid. It was zombies attacking Quislings, but you never would have known that to look at it. Quislings don't scream. They just lie there, not even trying to fight, writhing in that slow, robotic way, eaten alive by the very creatures they're trying to be.
Malibu, California. I don't need a photograph to recognize Roy Elliott. We meet for coffee on the restored Malibu Pier Fortress. Those around us also instantly recognize him, but, unlike pre-war days, keep a respectful distance.
ADS, that was my enemy. Asymptomatic Demise Syndrome, or Apocalyptic Despair Syndrome, depending on who you were talking to. Whatever the label, it killed as many people in those early stalemate months as hunger, disease, interhuman violence, or the living dead. No one understood what was happening at first. We'd stabilized the Rockies, we'd sanitized the safe zones, and still we were losing upwards of 100 or so people a day. It wasn't suicide, we had plenty of those. No, this was different. Some people had minimal wounds or easily treatable ailments, some were in perfect health. They would simply go to sleep one night and not wake up the next morning. The problem was psychological, a case of just giving up, not wanting to see tomorrow because you knew it could only bring more suffering. Losing faith, the will to endure, it happens in all wars. It happens in peacetime, too, just not on this scale. It was helplessness, or at least the perception of helplessness. I understood that feeling. I directed movies all my adult life. They called me the boy genius, the wunderkind who couldn't fail, even though I'd done so often. Suddenly, I was a nobody, an F6. The world was going to hell, and all my vaunted talents were powerless to stop it. When I heard about ADS, the government was trying to keep it quiet. I had to find out from a contact at Cedars-Sinai. When I heard about it, something snapped. Like the time I made my first Super 8 short and screened it for my parents. This I can do, I realized. This enemy I can fight.
And the rest is history.
I wish. I went straight to the government. They turned me down.
Really? I would think, given your career...
What career? They wanted soldiers and farmers. Real jobs, remember? It was like, hey, sorry, no dice, but can I get your autograph? Now, I'm not the surrendering type. When I believe in my ability to do something, there is no such word as no. I explained to the distress rep that it wouldn't cost Uncle Sam a dime. I'd use my own equipment, my own people. All I'd need from them was access to the military. Let me show the people what you're doing to stop this, I told them. Let me give them something to believe in. Again, I was refused. The military had more important missions right now than posing for the camera.
Did you go over his head?
To who? There were no boats to Hawaii, and Sinclair was racing up and down the West Coast. Anybody in any position to help was either physically unavailable or far too distracted with more important matters.
Couldn't you have become a freelance journalist? Gotten a government press pass?
That would have taken too long. Most mass media was either knocked out or federalized. What was left had to rebroadcast public safety announcements to make sure anyone just tuning in would know what to do. Everything was still such a mess. We barely had passable roads, let alone the bureaucracy to give me a full-time journalist status. It might have taken months. Months, with 100 dying every day. I couldn't wait. I had to do something immediately. I took a DV cam, some spare batteries, and a solar-powered charger. My oldest son came with me as my sound man and first AD. We traveled on the road for 1 week, just the two of us on mountain bikes looking for stories. We didn't have to go far. Just outside of Greater Los Angeles, in a town called Claremont, are five colleges: Pomona, Pitzer, Scripps, Harvey Mudd, and Claremont McKenna. At the start of the Great Panic, when everyone else was running, literally for the hills, 300 students chose to make a stand. They turned the women's college at Scripps into something resembling a medieval city. They got their supplies from the other campuses. Their weapons were a mix of landscaping tools and ROTC practice rifles. They planted gardens, dug wells, fortified an already existing wall. While the mountains burned behind them and the surrounding suburbs descended into violence, those 300 kids held off 10,000 zombies. 10,000 over the course of 4 months until the Inland Empire could finally be pacified. We were lucky to get there just at the tail end, just in time to see the last of the undead fall, as cheering students and soldiers linked up under the oversized, homemade Old Glory fluttering from the Pomona Bell Tower. What a story! 96 hours of raw footage in the can. I would have liked to have gone longer, but time was critical. 100 a day lost, remember? We had to get this one out there as soon as possible. I brought the footage back to my house, cut it together in my edit bay. My wife did the narration. We made 14 copies, all on different formats, and screened them that Saturday night at different camps and shelters all over L.A. I called it Victory at Avalon, the Battle of the Five Colleges. The name Avalon comes from some stock footage one of the students had shot during the siege. It was the night before their last worst attack, when a fresh horde from the east was clearly visible on the horizon. The kids were hard at work, sharpening weapons, reinforcing defenses, standing guard on the walls and towers. A song came floating across the campus from the loudspeaker that played constant music to keep morale up. A Scripps student with a voice like an angel was singing the Roxy Music song. It was such a beautiful rendition and such a contrast with the raging storm about to hit. I laid it over my preparing for battle montage. I still get choked up when I hear it.
How did it play with the audience?
It bombed. Not just the scene, but the whole movie. At least that's what I thought. I'd expected a more immediate reaction, cheering, applause. I would never have admitted this to anyone, even to myself. But I had this egotistical fantasy of people coming up to me afterwards, tears in their eyes, grabbing my hands, thanking me for showing them the light at the end of the tunnel. They didn't even look at me. I stood by the doorway like some conquering hero. They just filed past silently with their eyes on their shoes. I went home that night thinking, oh well, it was a nice idea. Maybe the potato farm in MacArthur Park can use another hand.
What happened?
2 weeks went by. I got a real job, helping to reopen the road at Topanga Canyon. Then one day a man rode up to my house. Just came in on horseback, as if out of an old Cecil B. DeMille Western. He was a psychiatrist from the county health facility in Santa Barbara. They had heard about the success of my movie and asked if I had any extra copies.
Success?
That's what I said. As it turns out, the very night after Avalon made its debut, ADS cases dropped in L.A. by a whole 5%. At first, they thought it might be just a statistical anomaly until a further study revealed that the decline was drastically noticeable only among communities where the movie was shown.
And no one told you?
No one. Not the military, not the municipal authorities, not even the people who ran the shelters where it was continuing to be screened without my knowledge. I don't care. The point is, it worked. It made a difference, and it gave me a job for the rest of the war. I got a few volunteers together, as much of my old crew as I could find. That kid who shot the Claremont stock footage, Malcolm Van Ryzen? Yes, that Malcolm. He became my DP. We commandeered an abandoned dubbing house in West Hollywood and started cranking them up by the hundreds. We'd put them on every train, every caravan, every coastal ferry heading north. It took a while to get responses, but when they came...
He smiles, holds his hands up in thanks.
10% drop throughout the entire Western safe zone. I was already on the road by then, shooting more stories. Anacapa was already wrapped, and we were halfway through Mission District. By the time Dos Palmos hit screens, and ADS was down 23%, only then did the government finally take an interest in me.
Additional resources?
No. I'd never asked for help, and they weren't going to give it. But I did finally get access to the military, and that opened up a whole new world.
Is that when you made Fire of the Gods? He nods.
The Army had two functioning laser weapons programs, Zeus and Emphel. Zeus was originally designed for munitions clearing, zapping landmines and unexploded bombs. It was small and light enough to be mounted in a specialized Humvee. The gunner sighted a target through a coaxial camera in the turret. He placed the aim point on the intended surface, then fired a pulse beam through the same optical aperture. Is that too technical?
Not at all.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I became extremely immersed in the project. The beam was a weaponized version of solid-state industrial lasers, the kind used to cut steel in factories. It could either burn through a bomb's outer casing or heat it to a point that detonated the explosive package. The same principle worked for zombies. On higher settings, it punched right through their foreheads. On lower settings, it literally boiled their brain till it exploded through the ears, nose, and eyes. The footage we shot was dazzling, but Zeus was a pop gun next to Emphel. The acronym stands for Mobile Tactical High-Energy Laser, co-designed by the United States and Israel to take out small incoming projectiles. When Israel declared self-quarantine and when so many terrorist groups were lobbing mortar rounds and rockets across the security wall, Emphel was what knocked them down. About the size and shape of a World War II searchlight, it was, in fact, a deuterium fluoride laser, much more powerful than the solid state on Zeus. The effects were devastating. It blasted flesh from bones that then heated white before shattering into dust. When played at regular speed, it was magnificent, but it's slow-mo. Fire of the Gods.
Is it true that the number of ADS cases were halved a month after the movie's release?
I think that might be an overstatement, but people were lined up on their off hours. Some saw it every night. The poster campaign showed a close-up of a zombie being atomized. The image was lifted right from a frame in the movie, the one classic shot when the morning fog actually allowed you to see the beam. The caption underneath read simply, "Next." It single-handedly saved the program.
Your program?
No, Zeus and Emphel.
They were in jeopardy?
Emphel was due to close a month after shooting. Zeus had already been chopped. We had to beg, borrow, and steal, literally, to get it reactivated just for our cameras. Distress had deemed both as a gross waste of resources.
Were they?
Inexcusably so. The M in Emphel's mobile really meant a convoy of specialized vehicles, all of which were delicate, none truly all-terrain, and each one completely dependent on the other. Emphel also required both tremendous power and copious amounts of highly unstable, highly toxic chemicals for the lasering process. Zeus was a little more economical. It was easier to cool, easier to maintain, and because it was Humvee-mounted, it could go anywhere it was needed. The problem was, why would it be needed? Even on high power, the gunner still had to hold a beam in place, on a moving target, mind you, for several seconds. A good sharpshooter could get the job done in half that time with twice the kills. That erased the potential for rapid fire, which was exactly what you needed in swarm attacks. In fact, both units had a squad of riflemen permanently assigned to them, people protecting a machine that is designed to protect people.
They were that bad?
Not for their original role. Emphel kept Israel safe from terrorist bombardment, and Zeus actually came out of retirement to clear unexploded ordnance during the Army's advance. As purpose-built weapons, they were outstanding. As zombie killers, they were hopeless duds.
So why did you film them?
Because Americans worship technology. It's an inherent trait in the national zeitgeist. Whether we realize it or not, even the most indefatigable Luddite can't deny our country's techno-prowess. We split the atom. We reached the moon. We filled every household and business with more gadgets and gizmos than early sci-fi writers could ever have dreamed of. I don't know if that's a good thing. I'm in no place to judge. But I do know that just like all those ex-atheists in foxholes, most Americans were still praying for the god of science to save them.
But it didn't.
But it didn't matter. The movie was such a hit that I was asked to do a whole series. I called it Wonder Weapons, 7 films on our military's cutting-edge technology, none of which made any strategic difference, but all of which were psychological war winners.
Isn't that
a lie? It's okay, you can say it. Yes, they were lies, and sometimes that's not a bad thing. Lies are neither bad nor good. Like a fire, they can either keep you warm or burn you to death, depending on how they're used. The lies our government told us before the war, the ones that were supposed to keep us happy and blind, those were the ones that burned, because they prevented us from doing what had to be done. However, by the time I made Avalon, everyone was already doing everything they could possibly do to survive. The lies of the past were long gone, and now the truth was everywhere, shambling down their streets, crashing through their doors, clawing at their throats. The truth was that no matter what we did, chances were most of us, if not all of us, were never going to see the future. The truth was that we were standing at what might be the twilight of our species, and that truth was freezing 100 people to death every night. They needed something to keep them warm. And so I lied, and so did the president, and every doctor and priest, every platoon leader, and every parent. We're going to be okay. That was our message. That was the message of every other filmmaker during the war. Did you ever hear of The Hero City?
Of course.
Great film, right? Marty made it over the course of the siege. Just him shooting on whatever medium he could get his hands on. What a masterpiece. The courage, the determination, the strength, dignity, kindness, and honor. It really makes you believe in the human race. It's better than anything I've ever done. You should see it.
I have.
Which version?
I'm sorry?
Which version did you see?
I wasn't aware...
That there were two? You need to do some homework, young man. Marty made both a wartime and a post-war version of The Hero City. The version you saw was 90 minutes?
I think.
Did it show the dark side of the heroes in The Hero City? Did it show the violence and the betrayal, the cruelty, the depravity, the bottomless evil in some of those heroes' hearts? No, of course not. Why would it? That was our reality, and it's what drove so many people to get snuggled in bed, blow out their candles, and take their last breath. Marty chose instead to show the other side, the one that gets people out of bed the next morning, makes them scratch and scrape and fight for their lives because someone is telling them that they're going to be okay. There's a word for that kind of lie. Hope.
Parnell Air National Guard Base, Tennessee. Gavin Blair escorts me to the office of his squadron commander, Colonel Christina Eliopoulos. As much a legend for her temper as for her outstanding war record, it is difficult to see how so much intensity can be compacted into her diminutive, almost childlike frame. Her long black bangs and delicate facial features only reinforce the picture of eternal youth. Then she removes her sunglasses, and I see the fire behind her eyes.
I was a Raptor driver, the FA-22. It was hands down the best air superiority platform ever built. It could outfly and outfight God and all his angels. It was a monument to American technical prowess. And in this war, that prowess counted for shit.
That must have been frustrating.
Frustrating. Do you know what it feels like to suddenly be told that the one goal you've worked toward your whole life, that you've sacrificed and suffered for, that's pushed you beyond limits you never knew you had, is now considered strategically invalid?
Would you say this was a common feeling?
Let me put it this way. The Russian army wasn't the only service to be decimated by their own government. The Armed Forces Reconstruction Act basically neutered the Air Force. Some distress experts had determined that our resource-to-kill ratio, our RKR, was the most lopsided of all the branches.
Could you give me some example?
How about the JSOW, the Joint Standoff Weapon? It was a gravity bomb, guided by GPS and inertial nav, that could be released from as far as 40 miles away. The baseline version carried 140 Blue 97B submunitions, and each bomblet carried a shaped charge against armored targets, a fragmented case against infantry, and a zirconium ring to set the entire kill zone ablaze. It had been considered a triumph, an unparalleled war winner, until Yonkers. Now we were told that the price of one JSOW kit, the materials, manpower, time, and energy, not to mention the fuel and ground maintenance needed for the delivery of aircraft, could pay for a platoon of infantry pukes who could smoke 1,000 times as many G's. Not enough bang for our buck, like so many of our former crown jewels. They went through us like an industrial laser. The B-2 Spirit's gone. B-1 Lancer's gone. Even the old buffs, the B-52 big ugly fat fellows, gone. Throw in the Eagles, the Falcons, the Tomcats, Hornets, JSFs, and Raptors, and you have more combat aircraft lost to the stroke of a pen than to all the SAMs, FLAC, and enemy fighters in history.